Hello, and welcome to a new series of Material Matters with me, Grant Gibson. I hope you're all having a tolerable new year in these extremely difficult times. We're on series 9 now, would you believe? But for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea behind the show is that I speak to a designer, maker, artist, or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. It gives me huge pleasure today to talk to the artist and designer Juli Bolanos-Derman. Juli is originally from Costa Rica, where she trained in graphic design. However, in 2010, she came to Edinburgh to study glass, and since then, her career has taken off. Her beautifully colourful, joyfully decorative, genuinely jaunty sculptures made from recycled glass has been cut and engraved, has been exhibited at the V&A in London, Dutch Design Week in Eindhoven, Makehauser and Worth in Somerset, Design Days Dubai, and the Corning Museum of Glass in the US, while she's also received commissions from the National Glass Centre Collection in Sunderland and the Royal Edinburgh Hospital. In 2015, she won an L Decoration British Design Award, while in 2017, she was selected for the Gerwood Makers Open. Juli, are you there?
Hello, Grant. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Where are you at the moment?
I'm back home in Costa Rica. I came home for the holidays just in time before the whole lockdown and came to here to see family for a bit and work from here.
Okay. How is the COVID situation in Costa Rica?
I think because we're in the tropics, it's a warmer weather and houses are more ventilated. And I think the rate of infection is going a bit slower. But don't ask me, I'm not very good with looking at the numbers. I just get a bit overwhelmed and I just try to use my mask and keep my distance and wash my hands 1,000 times a day. So that's pretty much my coping way at the moment.
And are you stuck there now with the travel corridors being closed?
I think so. I haven't looked at it really that much until closer to the time because everything is shifting so quickly that there's not much I can do. So I just get a bit overwhelmed and stressed. So I'm just going one step at a time. But I think with now, since I just got my residency from the UK, I would be able to get into the country.
Mm.
Of course, with a COVID test before boarding the flight and then doing the 10-day quarantine on the other side. But of course, if the flights don't get cancelled. So it's a lot of variables.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're not doing too well over here at the moment. So I would stay right where you are, quite frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
You were quite active in the first lockdown. You made a series of art classes for children entitled Stay Creative with Juli. Tell me a bit about that. How did that come about?
Well, it was just like on the first days of the pandemic when it all started, it was just like trying not to be completely, how to say, overwhelmed with the unknown and the uncertainty. And I started to be like, okay, you just wake up early, start working, keep a routine, try to be in contact with friends and family and go out for walks. And it was just in spring, so it was just such a nice surprise to make myself go outside for a walk at least 2 hours a day and just observe the surroundings and how they were constantly changing. And then, of course, like my need to draw and to put pen to paper, I had like some watercolor paints and I just started to paint and paint and paint and paint and understood that that just gave me like a sense of comfort and a surrendering to the uncertainty of it all and attempting to recharge from a place of joy. So I was thinking, how can I contribute in some way? And I was talking to, it was funny enough, I made a friend on Instagram and she happens to be Martha McNewton. From London.
Oh, who's the PR?
Yes. And I wasn't sure. I wasn't like very confident on how to promote it. And she was just like, hey, let's work on it together. I can help you with the press release aspect of it. And then she just gave me like the push to do what I do. Like I did the drawings, I scanned them. I did the promotion for Instagram and everything. And then with her writing and everything, it was a good collaboration to just share it online. So it's a free drawings in black and white for people to print, to trace, or to share with their kids if they want to. If they're a bit too stressed, they can just take a minute and recharge because it's just we're overwhelmed at the moment and it's a really tough time for everybody. So that was my way to contribute and I'm still looking forward to.
So the idea was that you do a drawing, somebody can download it from your website and then they color it in fundamentally.
Yes. Uh-huh. And it could be for kids or for adults.
Okay. And you also did a kind of series of, well, you probably don't know the show, but it's almost Blue Peter type makes. There's a little film about you making a rainbow for the NHS and how children could do that as well.
Yes, that was just a drawing. And I just came up with that because I had like a I have a hard time letting go of trash sometimes.
Well, we might talk about that later.
I'm a little bit of a hoarder in that way. I just see the potential in, let's say, the recycling bin. And there was like a cereal box and then some toilet roll, piece of carton. And I was just like, it would be really nice to do a rainbow to put on the window to thank the NHS workers. And it just came about that it became a 3D rainbow using the cereal box. And then I painted it and it was just like a how-to. I mean, it's nothing extraordinary. It's just, again, it's an invitation to see the potential in the discarded. And it's not just about glass. This is how I perceive the world and hence me collecting a lot of stuff that sometimes I don't know what to do with it.
So talking about collecting stuff, you seem to have adopted a new style of working as well. You've done this series called Powerful Ordinary Bonds, where you appear to be using found materials. There's a lot of elastic bands and I guess things that you find around your studio. How did that come about?
This was, again, when the pandemic started, I was just like, okay, as a creative entrepreneur, because we have to figure out how to do business with what we do. It's not just art. I was just like, there's an opportunity to do a creative short course with these Dutch collective called Dutch in Virtuals. And they just launched this project to do, it's called Dutch in Virtuals Academy. And it was a 3-month intensive course. And I applied and I got in. So it's always super interesting because I love their aesthetic and how it's more design, but I'm also always interested to challenge my practice and to step out of the comfort zone and how to push myself, because it's gotten to the point where I know how to make my glass sculptures and the audience have received them well, but also I want to do more and I want to push the boundaries of not just doing sculptures. I want to invite the audiences in different ways. And hence these powerful, ordinary objects. It was just like, since I didn't have the access, of course, to the machinery in the art college, which I used to rent. But now, of course, everything is shut down. And I was just like, what am I going to do with my practice for the sculptures that you see that people know me for? I use 10 machines and they're super laborious. And of course, I collaborate with other glass makers like glass blowers. And all of these objects that, how do I pivot? So at the moment this is not the ideal situation, but I was just like, what can I learn from this moment? And after 3 months of this really intense course, it just completely poked my way of thinking. And it's super interesting to understand the way Dutch and their design approach, and it's incredible. And then this collection came about and it was just like using the glass bits that I have collected from all my travels, from if I went teaching to Fraunau in Germany, or when I did my residency in India, I brought back some little glass pieces from India. Or if I travel to Europe, I like the Coca-Cola bottle from Italy, I bring it back. It's all of this compilation of objects that maybe they're not completely appropriated, but then if I just mix them with ordinary objects like a rubber band that came with the broccoli in the supermarket, that it ends up in the bin and it's been used once, I'm just inclined to be like, how can I present them in a different way for them to look precious, for them to have a new life, and also a second opportunity for them not to just be discarded objects?
It reminds me a little bit of a project that Hans Stoffer, the jewelry designer, did a few years ago, where he did a similar thing of taking things from his studio and creating new works of art with this detritus, really. But I'm interested in how the Dutch changed the way that you think, or how your thinking has evolved having met the Dutch.
I think it was really interesting because I was working nonstop and making 1,000 different samples, and I'm super determined. And when I was told, you need to work on this, I just went full force and I didn't stop. It was like, and I was just like, I'm going to make the most out of this opportunity. But then the curator, she was just like, you're not doing enough. You're still in your comfort zone. I was just like, but I don't know what else to do. And I was completely uncomfortable. But that, for me, that was a really good sign. Because if you just want to sit yourself in a vacuum where everybody tells you, yes, yes, this is perfect, then it's really comfortable there. But then in that moment, she gave me Wendy, the curator. She was just, you need to go full force and make it completely evident. So in the end, what I presented there, there's still a lot for me to take in. And I'm still just letting it just simmer a little bit longer. And then once I get back into the studio, I know that that work is going to influence my next step.
Okay.
It's also like a flow, a very important word that I'm choosing for this year is flow. And a stop. Fighting against that need to control stuff, because sometimes I'm very determined, yet that's hindering because you're just fighting against what the reality is. And a year after a pandemic, and now again in 2021, when we thought that we were going to get a bit of a breather. Still, things are a bit like we just need to relax and pay attention to what we have in front of us. And that's my practice. And that's why it translates directly into the work. And now I'm just like, okay, giving myself the time to understand, to be present. And later on, hopefully looking back, this will be an important time for transformation.
Yeah, yeah. Are you able to work in Costa Rica?
Well, I'm just doing admin here, which is the reality of a studio as well, that it's 50% at writing for grant proposals and doing new works. I have some things in the pipeline.
Okay, we'll find out about that towards the back end, I guess. I mean, one of the things we do on this show generally to give listeners a sense of how you work is to get the guests to describe their studio. Now, obviously, we're cheating a little bit because you're on the other side of the world right now. But never mind. Can you talk us through your working environment?
Well, I have to say that I love my studio. And it's Custom Lane. You've been there before.
I have been there.
This is my first studio since I graduated. I moved there like maybe 4 years. And I was sure that I didn't want just to move into any place. I knew that for me, and one of my needs is to have a sense of community. And this is why Custom Lane has been detrimental in my development. And because it was founded by Gunnar Groves Reins, he's the architect for Grass. And he has the vision of collaboration and a space for dialogue and to work with people. So I have my little studio. I'm really lucky because I'm one of the few spaces that has a door and a window. It's mostly like open plan space, but there's people from all different disciplines, such as architects, fashion, I cast in hair, the fashion designer, filmmakers and jewelers. So there's people from different disciplines, yet the important thing is that they're all entrepreneurs, creatives, and they have their own businesses. So it's been like, well, pre-pandemic, we would sit down in the kitchen. Well, you would happen to meet someone there for lunch, and then you would just happen to have a conversation of, what are you up to? What are you doing? And I would be like, I'm freaking out because I have to do my taxes. And they would be like, don't worry about it. Just call my accountant. And it's like that sense that you're not on your own and you're not having to figure out everything from scratch. So
yeah, yeah.
These are the things that I miss the most about my daily life when we had to be working from home.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Tell us about your studio itself. I mean, are you a messy worker? Do you have lots of things lying about, or is everything very neat and tidy?
It depends on the time. I think it goes in ebbs and flows because depending if I'm in the middle of a project, everything is everywhere. Yet it's a 2x2 space. I understand now that I work better when I don't have that much stuff out. So if I'm glass cutting, I clean the space completely and then I start afresh on that batch of work. So I take out the machine, bring out all my tools, bring out my apron. I do the glass cutting and then that might be like a couple of days of doing that. And then that's where I do all my admin. So as well, it has to be clean because of the glass dust as well. So I hoover and then I do the other batch, which might be like writing a press release or, I don't know, doing my taxes.
Taxes seem to be coming up quite a lot. They're on your mind at the moment, obviously.
No, I already did that. But it's just like, I get really confused with Excel things, with numbers. I think I'm a bit dyslexic. So I just have to be like fully focused on one task. And then I have all the papers around me. I organize them and then I put them away. That's the best way that I found that I work better.
This being Material Matters, I guess the big question is, why glass? Why glass in general? And then why recycled glass in particular?
Well, coming from Latin America, it's incredible because every time that I cross the pond, that's how we call the Atlantic back here, it just gives me a little bit of perspective. And just being away from the UK at the moment, I appreciate every time that I go back from a different perspective. In Latin America, the heritage traditions such as glass cutting or glass blowing or silversmithing, these are more expensive to import. And usually we would just buy these types of things from Europe or from China or from wherever. Mm. So the traditions haven't gotten here because, of course, the maintenance fees and the export fees, and it's really costly. Some people have tried to set up the studios here, but they haven't managed to sustain it unless they have like a massive factory. When I started doing glass in Costa Rica, the cost of production was high and you had to make the most out of every little detail, every little piece of material. And once I got to the art college, when I was doing my master's, I saw that everybody was doing glass blowing and they were just like, oh no, this one is ugly. This one is wonky. This one doesn't work. So they threw it out. And those were the bits that I found that had more charisma to a certain extent. They had a bit of personality. And for me, it's just like bringing in like the not perfect ones. And then let's say, for example, if I took that blown piece from the hot shop into the cold shop, which is my personality, I like to go take my time, in the cold shop, you can do a little bit here, hand cut this, go in on the saw and cut it into pieces. Imagine like a bottle. You cut the top, you cut it into three pieces. Those three pieces can be rearranged and become something new. So I think that the odd looking are the ones that I am more attracted to. And as well, like, I love the process of giving that piece of glass that was going to the bin a second chance.
Right. You've described yourself, I think, rather poetically as acting as a translator between the material and the ideal of what the object can become.
Yes, I think it's like, I don't know about you, but I remember being a little kid and people asked me, what did you want to do when you want to grow up? And I said, I want to be a mermaid, or I want to be something that's completely...
Yeah, professional cricketer for me.
Yeah.
Rather less romantic.
No, but I think it's also like, if you think about it, as a kid, you didn't have limitations. And it's that possibility of allowing yourself to not be put in a box just because things can't be. So when materials, it's like a little jug when it was growing up and he was asked, what do you want to be? He didn't want to be a jug, you know, like the wonder where you pour water. Maybe he wanted to be an astronaut, and maybe as a facilitator, I flow in the process. It sounds really woo-woo, but I mean, it's just like that nice possibility as a child that anything has a possibility to become whatever it wants to.
But you do give your objects kind of names. There's one piece called Carol, for instance, and particularly using film, they kind of quite often seem to, well, they come alive sometimes, your pieces.
Yes, I think in that case, I usually don't name the pieces until they're at the end, because
right.
I don't want to limit myself and I let them guide me in that way. But Carol was inspired by my late auntie, and she was super thoughtful about how she chose the shoes that she wore, the rings that she wore. She was like a very fashionable, and it reminded me of her because I imagine her like dancing to a little song, like a Costa Rican typical song from the 80s. Really sassy. I loved it. And then Carol choosing what to wear that day. And it was just that point of departure where it has a family connection for me, but it also connects to other people. Like, you're dressing for the day, that day. If you want to look very badass, then you choose a different, you know, because I enjoy that. And for me, that brings me joy. So for me, the important thing about my artworks is to bring that into people's life and an invitation to have a laugh. Because if not, for me, that's the important thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was intrigued hearing you talk, because it seems to me the way you're talking, using recycled glass, wasn't so much about environmental concerns. It was more a kind of practical needing the material.
Yes and no. I'm really stressed about sometimes the amount of trash we produce, to the point that I try not to think about it. And I try just to think like I'm trying to do my part, and then also like how the work becomes. I really like this term. I don't know where I heard it, but it was just described as an act of rebellion. If you reuse something, you're a rebel, because you're not caving into this capitalist world where we're told that we need a new pair of shoes, 10 pairs of shoes, just because. It's about wondering where things go after we finish using them, but also where are they coming from? Who made that? If it was a shirt that I bought for £1, what's the environmental cost of that? Who made it? How much money went back to that community that produced that shirt, and then the shipping, if it came from China or from, I don't know from where, and then what is the cost, not just in money. And just because I have a fiver to spend on a shirt, there's a moral aspect to our consumption habits. And that's why if I think about all the trash that I've produced over the years, and to think that it's in landfill, every little piece of trash that I produce had my name on it, how much would that be? So I'm just like, oh my God, okay, don't try to think about it. It's just like how to put it into practical aspects of your life and how you can be a bit more conscientious consumer. The work becomes a rebel. It's not just a pretty sculpture. It is so much more than that. It is aesthetics, and it just talks about my heritage, and it is very me. Yet it is so much more than that. And that sculpture represents that revolution and that possibility. And not just thinking about the material as something that's here to serve us, is how can we serve the material? Like, how can we show it compassion? And also, again, connecting it to our humanity, where I'm not perfect. What am I going to do? Throw myself to the bin and start over? No, we just have to work with what we have. And this is our starting point. So yeah, if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. I love that notion of showing your chosen material compassion. I think that's a lovely, lovely turn of phrase. Can we talk about your process? Because there are probably loads of listeners who don't know what cold working is. I mean, you have mentioned it already. So you've found your pieces of glass. How do you go about creating these kind of joyous sculptures that you finish with?
Okay, glass working has a million different techniques. Let's say the most popular one and the most romantic one is glass blowing.
Mm.
You have to be like really quick to make decisions. It's really warm. And then you have to work as a team. Yeah, the glass blowers that I work with are proficient and it's just incredible. But what I focus on, it's cold working, which is like, if you remember, like the whiskey glasses that have markings on them. And this is how you're taking away the material in after the piece is hand blown. You go into this other workshop where you're just surrounded by machines that use stones, diamond points, and sandpaper to sand down the material, smoothen, take away, cut. And that's where I, let's say, again, like if you have a beer bottle, you can cut it into pieces in different angles. Mm. And then those are the starting points for how I play with Legos, let's say, to put it as an analogy to for people to understand. And then I construct the new structures.
Mm. And where do you get your glass from? Do you spend a lot of time hanging around bottle recycling plants and things?
And then it depends. It's mostly from around from the community. The glass department at ECA are very kind to collect the discarded pieces from the art students.
Right. ECA being the University of Edinburgh.
Exactly. Yes, that's where I studied. Yes, and they have been super supportive with me being back in the studio and being able to hire all these machines because I only have one. And I use like 10. And then also now I've gotten in contact, for example, with Lindenlime, the gin manufacturer, that it's literally one block away from my studio. So I talked to them and I was just like, their bottle is beautiful. It's just like the most beautiful light green and it's just like nice ridges. So I told them if they had any extra discarded bottles and they said, yes, you can have the new ones. We can give you as many as you want. And I was just like, no, I don't want those ones. I want the ones that people return to you after they've used. Because I asked them if they recycle them and they said, I think they do, but they have extra. So they just gave me for my last project, they gave me like 25 and I just had the best time cutting those down. And it's just another color for the composition to be, I don't know, it's just a different one. So it's nice to include it in the pieces.
Mm. And sketching is a key part of your process.
Yes, that's like the internal dialogue. So every time it's not linear. Every creative process for me is, well, it's a bit chaotic, but not in the bad sense of the word. So it's just like an ebb and flow of whatever your curiosity guides you towards. That's my guide. Sketching, sometimes as a part of like a note taking or even at the end, it's just like another way to understand the piece from a different perspective. So it's just like building a little cloud where I'm just trying to understand myself better to make the message of my work very concise and for people to understand like the key points as quickly as possible.
Mm.
So maybe not logically, because for me, it's not about logic. It's more about what do people feel when they see or they're able to appreciate the practice, because in the end, that's the point of art, isn't it? To make someone feel joy or happiness or the vibrancy of the colors. What does that make you feel?
What is the key message of your work then, Huli?
I think it's just not to be too hard on ourselves and just to connect to that joyful sense of curiosity that we had as kids, because life was simpler. And sometimes I beat myself up about not being productive or not working that many hours. But sometimes if you take a break and you go for a walk and you observe the birds or you sit down with your dogs, and if you pay attention to what a dog does, they're just there all day, every day in front of you, paying attention to what you're doing. And then you regenerate from that sacred space of joy and then come back fresher to be more productive, to be with your kids, to deal with your family members, to be present with what you have in front. And I think this pandemic has been a great lesson in that we cannot control anything besides ourselves. So it's just, for me, I told myself, take a chill pill very often.
I mean, there is a wonderful sense of play.
Exactly.
In your work. I just wonder if your pieces reflect who you are as a person.
Yes, 100%. Everything is wonky because I cannot do a straight line if my life depended on it. So I just stopped fighting against that and just embracing it. But when I was doing my graphic design course, they told me, if you're going to make it crooked, make it 100% crooked, intended, you know, like with conviction. So people know that it was not a mistake. And then that evidently started to give so much more life to the sculptures. And I think that has been the element. If you take a look at one of the sculptures, since they're all crooked. If they were machine done perfectly to the millimeter, it would not have the same charisma, I think. So it's like one of those things that's a great example of flow in the creative process, where the piece guides me into being what it needs to be.
Right.
I'm just there a little bit curating, but also I just try not to be too critical, because then if I'm too critical, then a lot gets lost.
So you start with a sketch, but then depending on what the material does, that can change. Is that how it works?
No, I start more with an idea, and then I start sketching in 3D with the actual pieces, because sometimes right. I just do a drawing, and but that's going to be, it's really difficult, because unless I start taking out all the elements that I have in my studio, like all the different beer bottles or the different bottles, the one that I got in Italy, the Coca-Cola bottle, which has a beautiful pattern. I choose that because I'm drawn to that one. And then I start to include different elements. And then I'm just like, ooh, this looks good. Oh, look, the balance is a bit off in this one. The proportion might not work like that. This red needs, how about this little pink color, like the orchid that I'm inspired by that was in my mom's house, in my mom's garden. Or, you know, the vibrant green color connected with like a vibrant yellow. And it's just like, it's play, it's non-judgmental. And that's how I go from there. And then if I need to cut the piece a bit shorter because of the proportion, it feels a bit off, then I would usually, if I have had the machine there, I would cut it off and then go from there. So it's very raw.
It's intuitive, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Can we talk about your background?
Yes.
Did you always want to be an artist?
I think I always knew since I was a little kid. I always was keen in all the art classes, and I was very good at that. I had a really hard time learning how to read, and I wasn't very good at mathematics. Of course, I had an affinity towards art, so that came very natural to me. Yeah, it's just interesting to see how different brains work in different ways, but I always knew that, and then I ended up doing a graphic design course because my sister was doing one of those.
Yeah, yeah. If you found reading difficult when you were younger, was school tough in that case?
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, I cannot complain. It was just a matter of, I wasn't very applied, that's the thing. So I know that if I would have been more on top of my homework and stuff, it would have been easier. But I was just like more preoccupied with art, and I just wanted to paint. And But yes, I mean, now, of course, you just have to, whatever difficulty you have, you just have to put your head down to it. And of course, like for doing math, it's a bit more difficult, but you get on with it, you know. But when it came to deciding what to study, I decided for graphic design because I saw my sister. She was doing all of these, learning how to do everything from scratch, from doing all the drawings in pencil before starting in the computer. So I loved to see how she was training to do all of that. And that was a great base for, I mean, it was art yet applied to something practical.
I was intrigued by that. You felt you needed to apply it to something practical. Were you encouraged by your parents to do that?
Well, yes. They were just like, yeah, okay, great. You want to be an artist, but you have to be realistic now. You have to study something practical. And then if you want to think about that, because it's the conviction of an artist, you know, is you have to be really resourceful and how to figure out how to make it sustainable, and not just to make a living, but to make a good living. And as an entrepreneur, you have to have some sort of background. So
yeah, yeah. What did your family do, or what do they do, Huli?
My dad he doesn't practice anymore, but he is a surgeon of the teeth.
Oh, okay. A dentist.
A dentist, yeah. So
a dental surgeon.
And my granddad was the same. So my sister and I, she's a jeweler, we got the dexterity. We just choose a different material. And then my mom's side of the family, they're entrepreneurs. So on that side, it's a great example of how to make a living and the purpose of setting up a business that withstands time. And it's an interesting mix because I want to make art not just for me and for a privileged audience, but how, if I make to sustain myself, then how can I share that with more people? And how can I, from a place of privilege of being able to do a master's in art, because I know the privilege of that as a woman worldwide, that's a massive privilege. So how can I support my community and make art more accessible?
It's really intriguing because we've had quite a number of people whose parents come with medical backgrounds on this show. I don't know what the relationship between medicine, dentistry and art might be. Were you making? Were you and your sister always making at home in that case?
I was painting more, and my sister was always either sewing or knitting. But it's just interesting because you say about the connection between sciences and us as makers. I just find it's a different material. It's just like if you're an accountant, for example. My granddad, he recently passed away, but he was always, since he retired, since he was 60, he would always keep bookkeeping of everything he was spending. And he showed me his Excel sheet and his little notebook with all the staples and all the papers. But it brought him immense joy to know that everything was in its place and that everything was in order. So I just found that now, after I talked to him and he was like so proud and asking me how was I doing in my business and what was I doing, and he was giving me his business feedback, and I came back to do my taxes, and now every time that I sit down with my Excel sheet and my notebook, I mean, that's changing now because now everything's going to be digital, but I remember my granddad and I have a connection to him because my notebook is all in order. I can cross-check it with my Excel sheet. So it's just one of those things that whatever brings you joy, in that case, it could be a material. For my dad, it was the molding, the plaster for making the dental molds. But for my sister, it's silversmithing. And for me, it's glass. For some other people, it might be like, I don't know, organizing their closets by color coordination. And it could be like super satisfying. It's like that feeling.
I'm always slightly envious of people for whom figures obviously do a dance, because for me, they're just flat on a page and yeah, something tedious to get through. So what fascinated you with the material in the first instance? Why glass initially?
I think it was the most important thing is that even if it broke, it could be fixed and embellished, and it could evolve into something even better. Let's say, I remember I started glass fusing techniques, and I made a beautiful panel out of different colors and all the textures, and then appreciating under the light. But then after putting it outside in the sun for a bit too long, I just touched it and it broke, because of course the material, well, it just broke into little pieces. So it offered me an opportunity to understand what I could do with the broken pieces. Of course, I was disappointed at the beginning, but then eventually I just started to pay attention to these little pieces that broke and how the material invited me to wonder. And this is how a new series of, one of the first series called Little Animals, and how the shapes invited me to imagine as if it was a part of an animal. And then with illustration, I did the base drawing. And let's say, for example, I did a little bird, which had the most incredible beak. And it was with a bit of thick glass. And it was just beautiful to see how the two-dimensionality of a two-dimensional drawing came to life by using this broken piece of glass and adding it to the composition. But yeah, I think there's the potential to pivot from a mistake, what we would usually consider a mistake or something that we didn't plan, and just see where the material guides us into creating something that we could never have imagined. Because if I would have thought about it, it wouldn't be that special.
And did you try other materials before you arrived at glass?
Yes, I did a bit of ceramics, and then it was mostly painting or using all the, like I mentioned, for my undergrad in graphic design, we used like pencils, pens, all of these acrylics, watercolors. It was mostly that. And then I was drawn to that material as well, because I just find it mesmerizing how with light, the material comes to life. And that is something that I want to include more and more in my work, because it just gives you a completely intangible, a more romantic feel as well to the sculptures coming to life.
So you're in Costa Rica, you're studying graphic design, and you decide to go to Edinburgh. That doesn't seem necessarily like an obvious move. Why did you end up there?
I was just looking for the best glass programs worldwide, and the UK, to my surprise. I would have thought that it was Italy, where you would go to Venice, but it was more that...
Go to Murano or somewhere, yeah.
Exactly, but that was more like family tradition, so there was not like a master's program per se. The other option was like Australia, but that was too far away, and it was 4 years, and I didn't want to go for that long. But the UK had lots of options, and I ended up applying to three, and Edinburgh was the best option for me, because I just loved the international aspect of the city. It was small, but it didn't feel like a small town. It's like lots of cultures. It's a beautiful place. And then, funny enough, I didn't even consider at the time that my great-granddad from my mom's side, the Dorman family name, he was from Glasgow. And he was an engineer. And he, after fighting in the First World War, got a job in Costa Rica, organizing and building the railroad track of the Caribbean for banana plantations. And he came here and he stayed. So my little Frank, he never learned Spanish. And that's where my grandpa, the entrepreneur, was born. And this is how our family story started.
So your great-grandfather came from Glasgow to Costa Rica and stayed. And you went to Costa Rica to Edinburgh. And you've stayed in Edinburgh.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting. I mean, was it a culture shock when you arrived? I imagine there's not as much sunshine in Edinburgh as there is in Costa Rica, I'm guessing.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
It was really funny because the first 6 months, I just arrived after class. And I just got home and I just fell asleep because it was just like, I had to concentrate so much to understand the accent that I was exhausted by the end of it. But I love Scotland. It's just such an incredible, well, the UK, it's such an incredible part of the world. And I've stayed there for so long because of the people that have supported me to stay and of the friends that I've made and a community that is open to collaboration and how it's more about the project will be even better if I bring people from different disciplines and we have a conversation and work from that platform of collaboration. So that's how I've managed to make so many projects because people are open to do new projects and have the flexibility to work better together.
Yeah. It's interesting, Julie, because obviously the culture was different when you first arrived for you, but also glass was new to you, right? I mean, presumably you had a lot of catching up to do. It must have been quite tough.
Yes, but also since I originally came for a year and I was going to do a master's of 1 year, but there's not enough time. And I talked to the director of studies at that moment and I told her, would it be possible for me to join? I went there to do a master's for a year, but then I asked her if I could join the second years in the where they learn all the basics. So I was with the second years for the first year and I learned all the different techniques.
Right.
And that's where I understood that my personality goes better in the cold shop because it's more slow pace. I get to ponder and to decide what I want to do and be in the space the whole time. But of course, if you're in the hot shop, you have to make a decision in 1 second and you have to be like really quick. Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't like this. It's too stressful.
So you did have a go at glass blowing.
Yes, I did. And I learned and I loved it, but I just didn't like the decision making to be so quick. I was just like, do not pressure me. And 1 second, you know, hot shop, it's detrimental to the piece. It could either make it or break it. So I decided to specialize in glass cutting and it's the mark making. And it just lets me express myself in a really authentic way, because if you compare my work to a crystal cut French, I don't know, from Bacharach or whatever, I cannot compete with that style because it's really precise and I'm the opposite of precise. So I just embrace that mark making for it to be like, I like to understand it as like our need as humans to communicate through like cave paintings, or if you made a drawing as a kid, this is how we, I don't want to think about it too much, make it too logical. I just want it to be more of a feeling captured of that particular moment in time.
And how does your background, coming from a different continent, studying graphic design, feed into your work? I mean, it always strikes me there's a bit of Javier Mariscal, the Spanish artist and designer, in what you do.
It's a testament to, I'm constantly translating. I think in Spanish and I don't even know in which language I'm talking right now, I might forget.
You're definitely talking in English, just so you're aware.
Yeah.
It wouldn't work otherwise.
But it's sometimes I don't even think about it anymore, or I'm just talking in Spanglish, and that informs the decision making. I'm more Latin in the way of, I'm not about following the rules, how to say, step one, two, three. It's more about how can you bend the rules, being a bit cheeky, yet, of course, staying inside the guidelines, but also that it's a Latin way and it's a Costa Rican way that we're super resourceful. We are like, people here are sassy. They are like quick on their feet. If someone doesn't know how to speak English and you're coming a foreigner, they see, oh, you're a gringo. They think that you're from the US and they'll try and see how they can talk to you in English and ask you, I don't know, how's the family? And it's that sort of charisma and just going with the flow that I think characterizes very Costa Rican that way. But it's also interesting to see how every time that I say I'm from Costa Rica, that's a calling card that people are just like, they might not remember my name or the work, but they're just like, okay, this person from there, that's like the wildlife and the forest and...
And the color, presumably, because your work is very colorful.
Yes.
I mean, it doesn't look British, your work.
Exactly. And that was something that at the beginning when I started making work, it was really like the rainbow. And I didn't understand why, but of course, as the more I practiced and the more refined the work got, I learned how to use it to mix colors, but I didn't logically think about it because I wanted to go a bit more neutral. But then that's what the curiosity decided in that moment. So that's why I think the work is true to itself, because it is what it is. And the vibrancy, if you take a look at just where I grew up, the garden where I grew up, it's just an explosion. It's like so vibrant. It's really lush. And I grew up with my cousins playing in the backyard, eating dirt and imagining worlds where everything was possible. It's really funny.
But now you're a permanent citizen of the UK, lucky us. I'm intrigued with everything that's going on with Brexit and the sense, there is a sense that the UK is fragmenting. I mean, there's lots of news about, you know, the changes going on in Northern Ireland and supermarket shelves being empty. Do you feel Scottish or British?
Scottish. Yes. I think as a connection to my great-granddad, and then also there's a different feel when you go to London or to England. I mean, the UK, everybody has, Wales is incredibly stunning. England is beautiful as well. But I think that all my friends are, I've been there and I think I will stay there.
Should we talk about your use of film, which you seem to have been adopting more and more recently? You made a delightful stop motion short with Bridge Films called Our Common Humanity, for instance, where your pieces, as we've discussed, came alive. Why film as a tool for communication?
And I think it's the next step forwards to like how to communicate glass when it comes alive. So film, and of course, well, the technology is advancing, and how do we invite a wider audience into our studio? If I exhibit the work in London or in Edinburgh, it's a shame that not many people can come and see it, or maybe, I don't know, 2,000 people can come to the exhibition. But again, for me, it's just how can I invite a wider audience to participate? And now, of course, technology is moving forward and everybody has a tablet or a phone, and that's where people are, the consumption of media. So I think when I talk about the work coming to life in the studio, that Our Common Humanity, the project, it was a natural progression. I wanted to do for my hospital, the Royal Edinburgh Hospital Commission, after the work being delayed for like 4 years. I was just like, how can I justify this time? And in the meantime, how can I communicate about the project?
So hang on, how come it was delayed for 4 years?
It was supposed to, the hospital was being built. The commission was supposed to go in the lobby.
Oh, I see.
And then there was a mix-up between the building of the hospital, and then there was no place to put the commission because the lobby had become like an entrance now.
Right.
Like emergency entrance, so they cannot put the artwork there. So that's why we've had to pivot and put that one in the back burner. But I was just like, I want to use a little bit of this budget and self-funded to not let this idea lose steam. Like, so I decided, why can I do, not just to do the same thing that I'm known for, but to push further. And that was in that collaboration with Bridge Films. I was wanting like something of an idea, and I started to talk with a filmmaker, with Diego. And he was just like, but okay, so we do this, and then we do this, and then we do this. And when it came together, it was brilliant, because of what I had envisioned at the beginning, it wasn't one third of the greatness of, that it became, because of his idea and his execution, and then how we, co-directed the film. And it's just such a beautiful little, if people ask me, what do? I send them that 5 minute film.
Well, it's a lovely thing, and I implore people to go and have a look. I think it's on YouTube.
Vimeo.
It's a lovely thing because it starts off as quite a kind of conventional documentary about you as a maker, and there are many, many films about makers out there of this fashion with you in the studio, and then you talking about your work, as you do very eloquently, and then you leave and these pieces on your workbench just come alive, and it's completely delightful.
Yeah, I think,
and unexpected.
Yes, I was surprised when I saw it as well, because it encompasses, for me, it's like a life motto that we can try to do our best and control 50% of things, but the rest is serendipitous, and we can just let go, because it's, what we can do is just put the best intention forward. The rest, it will just flow as it is. So the work, when I leave the studio, let's say they come to life, and I'm not the first person or artist to think about like, oh yes, the piece is coming to life and then being animated, but it was just like a way for, this is how, like in my childlike curiosity and mind, that's how I see the pieces, having a conversation at night when nobody's there. And what happens when you leave the room? It's like the Toy Story.
Our hour or our time is nearly up, Juli. So it's the kind of the cliche classic last question. What are your plans for the future? I mean, I guess this is quite difficult to know where you are right now.
I think, well, for me, this year is more about pivoting and how to do strategy where, again, where the work reaches a better audience. And maybe not just in being a good sculpture artist, or but how can I facilitate spaces for people to engage with art, for them to feel good. And I'm not quite sure how that's going to pan out, but I'm hopeful. And I think that now this has been an opportunity for people to join forces and to share. I don't know, it's just brought our priorities to our forefront and to make sure that the work has purpose, because I want to eventually have a foundation for to support kids into art. But it's, I mean, that's the big picture. And because for me, the art has been incredible.
I mean, it sounds as if you're keen to step away from the kind of classic make a piece of work for a collector's market. Would that be fair?
No, but I think I love making. I love making. And this is something that I will continue to do. It will just evolve. It won't just stay there. And every piece that that anybody makes is imprinted with that particular moment in time. If it was done while you were in lockdown, I don't know. I just, when I see one sculpture, I remember particularly when I did it and how I was feeling. And it's just like a little memento. And how will people look back at the work? And for us now, what will people find in like archaeological finds? What would they find of us? That's what I'm just like, I'm just keen to work towards a... to make work, not just because I can, but because it has purpose. It's more about intention, I think.
So more purposeful work in the future.
Yes.
That's a nice place to leave it. Juli, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Grant.
And to discover more about Juli's delightful work, go to julibd.com. As ever, there are images from the interviews, as well as little films and other things on my Instagram page, Grant on Design. And you can find all the podcasts I've done, sign up to my newsletter and lots of other stuff at grantondesign.com. Finally, and this is really important, if you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. And it'd make me really happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. You'll be helping to take the message of the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. Thanks so much for listening, and please stay safe and well.